The Fern Line is supported by the Alaska Rock Gym, providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995. Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms. Stop by anytime to take a tour of the facility or check out the Alaska Rock Gym online at alaskarockgym.com.
Hey, Evan, did you hear that?
Dude, it's a hoarding marmot. Looking for that last-minute piece of kit before heading into the hills? Make sure and stop by the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need from high-end mountaineering gear, cross-country and downhill ski equipment, as well as a fine selection of local guidebooks, maps, and yummy trail snacks. Stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you roll through town or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com. All right, let's get to the show. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 3, I'm chatting with alpinists, wilderness adventurers, and creative spirits who live their lives inspired by the mountains. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with inspiring people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. Well, hey friends, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. Before we dive into today's show, I just want to remind listeners that if you enjoy The Fern Line, there's a few simple ways you can really help out. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can tell someone directly. Tell your friends, your climbing partners, people you think might dig The Fern Line, let them know it's out there. And if you want to support this show from the ground up, you can become a monthly subscriber on Patreon. Just head on over to patreon.com/thefernline and you can sign up there. All right, well, the time has come to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or your trusty, broken in and patched up pack raft and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line.
A bit about being able to accept uncertainty, and that's something that I'm not good at by nature, and I think being able to embrace that as much as possible, especially, you know, as you get older and realize that life is inherently uncertain and tenuous and things are gonna be lost along the way. When the world makes you question your own
thinking. On today's episode of The Fern Line, we'll get to know author and wilderness adventurer Caroline Van Hemmert. Caroline has an impressive life resume. She's a mother of two boys, holds a PhD in wildlife biology, as well as an MA in creative writing, and she just published her first book titled The Sun is a Compass. The book, which recently released to critical acclaim, chronicles Caroline and her husband's 4,000-mile human-powered expedition from the Pacific Northwest rainforest all the way to the Arctic coast of Alaska. I recently got a chance to speak with Caroline about this journey, about the literal ups and downs over mountain passes and glaciers, the life lessons she learned along the way, as well as her process of writing about it. Our conversation starts off with Caroline describing leaving the shores of Bellingham, Washington, in untested rowboats that were handcrafted by her husband, Pat.
They had never touched water before we got to Bellingham and got ready to launch them. And that wasn't originally our plan, but we sort of found out that expedition-style rowboats weren't available to purchase. So, you know, long story short, Pat ended up building them, came up to the end of our time to leave, and they got shipped down to Bellingham. And, you know, we'd done a few sessions on the rowing machine at the gym, but we didn't actually have a ton of time to be committing to training. And the water was all frozen in Alaska at that time anyway. So we just, you know, figured, well, we know the ocean. We spend a lot of time doing other kinds of boating. How hard can it be? And, you know, we figured it out, but it was a pretty steep learning curve, as you can imagine. So we're pushing off from Bellingham Bay, and some friends were watching us from the dock, and they'd actually seen us off on a couple of other adventures, and I'm sure every time thinking, like, oh, I hope they come back. But, you know, we're waving at them, it starts hailing, and kind of finally we get to a place where they can't see us anymore and just duck behind and kind of get ourselves sorted out. And took a while, for sure, to figure out how to operate a rowboat. There's a lot of things about it that are very different from kayaking or other kinds of boating. You know, you're facing backwards is a huge one, and there's a lot of pretty unique rowing muscles that we discovered very quickly. I remember leaping out of my rowing seat repeatedly thinking that there were bees stinging me in the behind, and then I realized it was just, you know, nerves that were being touched in ways they hadn't before. So there's definitely a lot of physical learning involved, but there was also, you know, just the trying to understand, like, what our limits were and what the boat's limits were in big water. It was a pretty stormy time of year. But fortunately, the boats were incredibly stable. We could take on so much bigger seas than we would certainly in kayaks and even in a small skiff. So it ended up being the right mode of transport. It just took a little while to figure it out.
Yeah, it seems like an understatement to call Pat a craftsman. He seems talented on another level when it comes to building things by hand.
That is very true, yeah.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting that I kind of got a kick out of, where you kind of meet random people who maybe in a normal day in the city, you wouldn't think about or take the time to introduce yourself to them. But you and Pat are going up the coast and sleeping on these beaches surrounded by houses, but you ended up meeting kind of random people and they would invite you into their houses or offer to feed you. What was that like?
Yeah, it was really amazing. Pat and I are both sort of introverted, I guess, by nature. And so, you know, we're not going to be the people showing up and starting the party or anything. So it was, I think it was, those are the kind of settings we probably do best in terms of meeting people, where it's just kind of a collusion of circumstances. Then you find yourself, you know, talking to somebody who, of course, is wondering why you've showed up on their beach in a dry suit looking like you just got off a shipwreck or something. And pretty naturally, conversation follows from there. And people are incredibly generous, as I think they often are when, you know, you're in their zone and you're clearly out on an adventure and they're interested in hearing what you're doing. And then in turn, you often end up hearing many, many interesting stories of their own lives. And so people were, yeah, very willing to help us out and wanted to hear about what we were doing. Many people thought we were crazy. You know, they didn't like the idea that we were going to Alaska in March in these little boats, but, you know, they still were excited for us and encouraging for the most part.
Right. So on that first leg, I guess, between Bellingham and when you got to your cabin, what was the most challenging situation that you faced?
Really, the hardest part was that making the decision whether to go or to stay on any given day. So the forecast, you know, we did get some amazingly calm, beautiful days, but there were a lot of days where it was pretty borderline. And so it was small craft advisory or, you know, winds of 20 knots or something like that, which it can be okay, but it can also turn ugly in a hurry. And so each day we had to make the call of whether that was something we felt comfortable taking a risk with, and then always be thinking ahead to, like, where's your next sort of safety pullout point.
Right.
And with the rowboats, it's not quite as flexible as, say, a pack raft or even a kayak, a hard-sided kayak or something, because the boats are difficult to pull out of the water and they're heavy and they're tough, but they're also made of plywood and they're somewhat fragile, plywood and fiberglass. So I think that was probably the hardest part, is that every day we sat waiting, we knew that we were that much farther away from our ultimate goal, but, you know, kind of having to make that constant call in the gray area of, is this worth going for today or not?
Right. So you guys ended up making it to your cabin. How long from Bellingham to your cabin? How long did it take?
It was about 7 weeks in total, 6.5, 7 weeks.
Okay. And then, so you get to your cabin and you hung out there for, was it like 3 or 4 days or was it longer?
Yeah, it ended up being about 4 days. We would have loved to stay longer.
But... Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you, how did it feel to get there and how did it feel to leave?
Yeah, getting there was probably one of the most satisfying things I've experienced. We showed up and got in, and it was a pretty stormy day, and our beach is very exposed, so we got kind of slammed by waves as we were getting in and felt very happy to get to the cabin. It had also been one more big storm cycle leading up to that, and it was wet and cold and sleeting, and we got to the cabin, and I kind of parked myself on the couch in front of the wood stove, and there was definitely nowhere else I wanted to be for a very long time. But I think we had been well trained with the rowboats and watching the weather that we kind of knew if we had a weather window,
right. There
was no choice but to go. And so that was the same case for the cabin. You know, we gave ourselves a couple of days there, and then we started watching the weather, and there had been a big storm cycle that dumped a bunch of snow on the mountains. And so we were pretty apprehensive about that in terms of the crossing, just because of a lot of steep avalanche terrain. But it had warmed up a lot, and we were hoping that the slopes had sort of shed, and we're keeping an eye on that. You know, as you mentioned before, there's a pass that we look at right from our cabin, and that's the one we had to go over. So we had the spotting scope on it, and we're kind of keeping tabs on it daily and watching the avalanches rumble down. And but once we got what looked like the best weather window we were going to get for a while, we decided that, you know, we need to go. And that was a hard decision to make kind of leave. And of course it's never straightforward. It was the same kind of thing. It was a windy day. We had to cross Lynn Canal in our pack rafts with really heavily loaded with skis and a lot of climbing or mountaineering equipment and food. And so we were a bit nervous about the crossing. I think it's 5 or so miles across and pretty big exposed water there. But it did end up calming down, and the fact that it was, you know, clearing and the water was calm enough anyway for boating kind of gave us no choice but to leave.
Right. So you take off across Lynn Canal in heavily loaded pack rafts. You get to the other side, and you start, it was essentially like a bushwhack up to the glacier.
Right, yeah. So we're hiking through the forest. It wasn't as bad at bushwhacking as Southeast Alaska can offer, but it was thick enough. And, you know, our bodies were pretty strong from rowing, but we definitely had not been doing any hiking or walking at all other than hauling our boats up and down the beach. So that was a bit of a harsh transition to have everything in the boats and then suddenly go on our backs and start hiking up a pretty steep slope through thick brush. And yeah, it was a bit of a reality check.
So you made it up over the pass, and then maybe just describe the landscape and talk about what it was like from the pass back down into the lower country. And I know that you ended up heading to a lodge and getting some food. Talk about that leg.
Sure. So we needed to cross over the mountains and kind of cross the Canadian border and then drop down into Tagish Lake, which would eventually feed us into the headwaters of the Yukon River. And the actual distance between Lynn Canal and Tagish Lake is quite short. But there was a lot of really steep terrain to navigate. And so there are big mountains and really steep passes. And because of the recent avalanche conditions, we realized after making that first crossing over the pass that it wasn't safe to continue on those same aspects at such steep angles, steep slope angles. And so we ended up having to drop down. It's big kind of ice fields, but until you get to that point, it's fairly disconnected, so there are some, you know, steep valleys and a lot of steep passes that we needed to go up and over, and we didn't feel safe doing that, so we had kind of an alternative route outlined on the map, and we chose that instead, which required that we get off of one glacier and get back on to another one that would eventually lead us into Canada. And those transition zones, for anyone who spent any time, particularly in, you know, coastal mountains, the transitions between the glacier's terminus and either the moraine or the ocean can be really steep and broken. And those are usually places we try our best to avoid. But in this case, we felt like that was safer than trying to grapple with avalanche conditions. And so we finally found a way, kind of worked our way down in onto the moraine of one glacier and then found a fin of ice that carried us up onto the other glacier, which we think we got really lucky because everything else was just steep, really technical ice climbing, and we weren't equipped to do that kind of climbing, and I'm not sure we would have been able to anyway. And then got up onto this broad ice field that took us into Canada, and actually the descent on the other side was really gentle. It was much better than we were anticipating on the dry side, and it was pretty cool as we were coming down into the Tagish Lake drainage. So that's kind of where it splits, you know, all of the water from there on flows into the Yukon. And almost immediately it just felt different. It was dry pine forest. We saw caribou shortly after getting onto that side, which, you know, there's no caribou on the, certainly on the coastal side where we are. So just a very different environment. It was kind of like the rain shadow effect in real life, which was cool to see. And then Pat had arranged a resupply at a small remote lodge on Tagish Lake, or at least I thought he had arranged a resupply. Somehow the communication got a little bit garbled. Pat blames it on a heavy accent, but when I actually spoke to her, I was not so convinced that that was the problem. Yeah. But anyhow, we decided to leave a bit of our food behind when we realized how heavy our loads were going to be leaving the cabin, and showed up pretty hungry. And I was like, oh, good, well, we're going to get our resupply now. And we got to the lodge, and the people were very nice and very welcoming, and, you know, they fed us dinner, and but didn't seem to know anything about a resupply or any food that we were supposed to pick up. And so it took some, sort of careful begging, I guess, to eventually get a little bit more food to take us to Whitehorse. But it was a hungry few days, for sure.
Right. I'm not going to give it all away, but that was a really funny, entertaining part of the book, for sure. describing that. So from, I think it was Whitehorse, is it to Dawson City, there's a long stretch of river that you guys floated in a canoe. And what was that part of the trip like?
That was a really nice connection between kind of the east side of the mountains and then getting us into Dawson City, which would allow us to start making our way toward the Wind River. And I think, you know, in other circumstances, having a rental canoe and kind of a guidebook that tells you exactly, you know, where the campsites are and how many miles between destinations would not have appealed to us. But on that trip, it was kind of the perfect vacation, I guess, after a pretty challenging section in the mountains and, you know, 6 or 7 weeks of pretty intense rowing. So, you know, we bought a box of wine and got a bunch of junky snacks and kind of sat back and enjoyed the canoe ride. And it was early in the season, so there weren't too many people on the river. And it was actually a really beautiful part of the trip. Enjoyed it a lot more than I was expecting to. But it did give us a chance to kind of have some downtime, which was mostly good. But then those were also inevitably the times when too many of the sort of life things come back into conversation, you know, what are we doing? What are we going to do after this trip?
Right.
What are our goals and aspirations? All that stuff. So
you're getting into kind of, I guess it would be, you're going through the Tombstone Mountains, and that's kind of getting you up into, is that like Northwest Canada?
Yeah, that's right. So Northwest Canada, Yukon, and then shortly after into the Northwest Territories.
Right. Maybe you can kind of just take it from the Tombstone Mountains and just kind of tell the story of you guys going up to the Arctic coast.
In crossing the Tombstone Mountains, that ended up being a lot more difficult than we were expecting. We had seen, you know, the pictures and driven by and saw these beautiful open ridges that looked like amazing hiking. And it turned out that in early June, it was still very snowy up high, and but already brushy down low. So that part ended up being kind of our first real long hiking leg, and it was a pretty painful one. But we eventually got to Tombstone Park and then started making our way toward the confluence with the Wind River, where we had boated in our previous trip with the bark canoe. And that was really interesting, fun terrain. There were some challenging pack rafting rivers, and a lot of them we had almost no information about. So we'd kind of hop in and, you know, check it out, scout around the next bend. And it was a lot of in and out of the boats, which kept things really interesting. And so all of that was really pretty fun part of the trip, and pretty exciting. And then we got back to the Wind River, and that was, you know, sort of a blast from our past, I guess. 10 years previous, we had been on the river at almost the exact same time of year, you know, as much younger people, kind of in our earliest months of our relationship. And then from there, we were headed up to the Mackenzie River. So we took the Peel River, and then to the Mackenzie River. And, you know, we knew we had a bit of a challenge to get from the Wind River area to the Arctic coast, which was somewhere we really wanted to check out. And on paper, the Mackenzie River looked like, you know, a very logical option. It flows north to the coast. It was more or less in the area we wanted to be. And so we thought, well, you know, we've heard some horror stories about bugs in slow water, but how bad can it really be? And we got on the river, and pretty quickly we realized that bad was a whole lot worse than either of us had ever imagined. And, you know, we'd done quite a lot of previous trips in Alaska and in Canada, and still had never seen anything quite like that. And it was definitely the low point on the trip for both of us. And I think it was the only time that we both questioned, you know, what we were doing and if we wanted to continue, and kind of brought everything around to the point of it, our future in the trip being doubtful. And, you know, and it was kind of ironic. I was thinking about it. It wasn't because it was physically challenging. Like, almost every other section on the river, I mean, on the trip was more physically challenging. And it wasn't because it was scary. We weren't dealing with a lot of really, really high risk situations. It was just that it was downright miserable. And we were dealing with a really strong headwind. And in some cases, the Mackenzie River braids into a, you know, million little channels up near the Arctic coast. And the way that the wind and the currents work, we were actually paddling upriver a lot of the time. So it was, at times we were making, you know, 0.1 miles per hour in the pack rafts, and the mosquitoes were unreal, and the mud was unreal. It's like you step out of the boats into the mud bank and sink up to your thigh. And so it's kind of like swimming on top of this mud flats. And so anyway, it was a pretty miserable time. But that said, it was almost what we needed to fully appreciate the experience of hitting the Arctic coast, which was amazing. We showed up, and, you know, within a few hours, it transitioned. We were on the Mackenzie River for quite a few days, but then within a few hours of being kind of in the thick of the Mackenzie River Delta, we were suddenly hit the coast, and it was a completely different world. Very much the sort of Arctic coast that I had envisioned, and, you know, you read about in Barry Lopez's Arctic Dreams, and, you know, there's sandhill cranes, and the sky is huge, and the horizon goes on forever, and their bugs were brought down by the wind, and yeah, just a really amazing transition to get there.
Yeah, it sounds like the kind of place, like, you can, you know, you can read about it, but it must be very different to actually be there and actually see it and feel it and experience it for yourself. I got the vibe, at least at that part in the book, of just describing, like, the history, and you were able to sense and feel the history and that it was changing. What was that like?
Yeah, so I think that came about more as we started traveling along the coastline. You know, the topographic maps, which is not unusual for a lot of parts of Alaska, they've recently been updated. But at the time, you know, they were in the maps were made in the 50s.
Wow. And
so they were, you know, they were old and not very accurate. And I think that their level of accuracy had really decreased in recent years because of the rapid erosion taking place along the coastline. And so we, you know, we were seeing that firsthand. And then as we met people occasionally on the coast, and there were not many people, but as we got further west into Canada in Herschel Island, you know, there were some park rangers there who talked a lot about the changing conditions. And our first night on the Arctic Ocean, we encountered two moose waiting almost a mile offshore, which was definitely not what we were expecting to see. And I think that was, you know, kind of a one indication of some of the things that are changing up there, and talking to people and subsequently reading about it in the scientific literature. You know, moose are certainly moving farther north, and there are a lot more in the Mackenzie Delta region than there used to be. So there were a lot of changes like that that, you know, that you can read about again from a distance or hear about on the radio. But then when you actually see it in person, it's very obvious that things are changing now. And people weren't so interested in talking about the politics of it, or, what might happen, or what do the models tell you. They just said, this is, you know, these are our lives. This is what it looks like now. And it didn't used to look this way. And everything's, yeah, different.
Right. So you're on the Arctic coast. And then at some point in time, you start heading south again and in to do a traverse of the Brooks Range. Go ahead and just tell the story of that leg.
Sure. So we decided to, we did almost all of our resupplies by the Postal Service. So going to Arctic Village from Kaktovik made a lot of sense, and we allowed us also to cross through the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is something we had wanted to do for a long time. So we headed south into Arctic Village and picked up a resupply, and we actually mailed our pack rafts from Arctic Village to Anaktuvik Pass, because besides one kind of major river crossing, we wouldn't need to do any boating. We could stay on the crest of the range and follow that for the most part and be a lot lighter without our boats. We did have one big river to swim that almost turned into a really bad situation. But beyond that, we were able to stay pretty high. In the first part of the Brooks Range, in the first part of our time, I guess, in the eastern Brooks Range, the weather was decent. There were definitely some challenging steep slopes and the endless tussocks that anyone who's traveled in northern Alaska is well familiar with. But in general, it was pretty good travel. But then about halfway through, shortly after we'd crossed the Hull Road, where we picked up one more resupply, the weather turned for the worst, and we ended up having some of the heaviest rains, I think, that at least at that time were, you know, had occurred on record in late July and in early August. And we ended up having to deal with really heavily flooded creek crossings and river crossings, and got one more resupply at Anaktuvik Pass and picked up our rafts there and started doing some additional boating, which was mostly good, but again, because the rivers were running so high, some of it was a bit more technical than we were anticipating. And along the way, we had a pretty terrifying encounter with a predatory bear that shook our confidence, especially at that stage in the trip when we were feeling strong and pretty on our game and very used to sleeping in the wilderness. Fortunately, we didn't obviously get eaten, and I'm still here to tell the story, but it was definitely a scary experience. And then shortly after that, we made it to Takahula Lake in Gates of the Arctic National Park and picked up one more resupply there and met a really wonderful person who was caretaking at the one kind of in-holding in the park. And from there, followed a route that we were hoping was going to take us to the headwaters of the Noatak River, which was really our last major leg of the journey. And because of all the recent rain and stormy weather, there was a lot of snow up in the mountain passes. It was pretty early season to have that much snow on the ground. So we ended up trying a couple of times this route that we had penciled on the map and were pretty confident about, and just couldn't do it safely. And so we ended up having to take a much longer route kind of around the mountains and then cross a different pass that we knew nothing about, and eventually did make it to the headwaters of the Noatak River. But by that time, we were very lean on our food supplies and were pretty beat down between the snow and the difficult terrain and just being, you know, wet day in and day out for several weeks in a row. But we finally made it to the headwaters of the Noatak River, which was where we had arranged for the one and only airdrop resupply on the entire trip. And that was mostly because there wasn't really any other option that we could come up with for a resupply that, you know, was close to a community. So we thought, okay, we're in, you know, pretty good shape. We finally made it through the mountains. This is our last leg. Like, it should be pretty smooth sailing from here. We just have to paddle down this river and make it out to Kotzebue. And that turned into one of the more epic moments on the trip, because the resupply plane couldn't get to us for almost 5 days. And so we were essentially without food for almost that entire time. And yeah, I think that, you know, it's easy to think about all the stories we've heard of people doing stupid things in the wilderness and getting themselves into trouble and running out of food. And it's like suddenly we were in that exact same position. And there was nothing we could do about it except wait. And that was very difficult and pretty scary, but in a different way than sort of the acute fears that maybe we get more accustomed to dealing with in the mountains, where you're afraid of a very specific hazard. And in this case, it was just, I don't know, will the plane come in time? And I think in any other situation, we would have figured, like, yeah, of course, the weather will clear eventually. But we had just had 3 weeks straight of basically unflyable weather. And so that wasn't, you know, if we were waiting for 3 weeks, I'm not sure that we would have been able to survive on that. And there wasn't really any choice for getting out at that point besides just waiting. We were too low on food reserves and too low on energy to think about, you know, walking out or boating out or any other option like that. So it was, that was a strange way to not end the trip, but at so, you know, such a late point in the trip and after having been through so many other challenging situations, it was kind of the last thing that we had worried about.
Sounds like you and Pat, like in the Brooks Range, like towards getting towards the end of the trip, were challenged.
We got our butts kicked. Yeah. Yeah, we were riding pretty high, you know, feeling like we were the strongest we'd ever been in our lives and had really found a rhythm, and in many ways didn't want the trip to end. But then we had, you know, several setbacks in a row of things that really kind of caught us off guard and definitely left us feeling pretty humbled, which I think is probably a good way to leave a wilderness trip. But yeah, we had no question of the fact that we were not in charge.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to fathom, like, the amount of experience that you guys attained on that trip is just mind-boggling. You know, all of the adversity, like all of the highs, all of the lows, all of the things that you have to kind of just figure out as you go. Like, there's no way around that. You can plan for things, but there's some things you just can't really plan for it, and you just have to deal with it. And it seems like this trip was like the ultimate test for that.
Yeah, that's very true. And I would say it was changed my mindset, you know, even coming back into ordinary life afterwards, is that just that ability to be okay with not knowing everything in advance. And right. That's something that's hard for me to do just because of kind of my personality. And I like to gather information. I'm a scientist, and that's kind of how I approach a lot of how I, you know, operate in my life, is I like to know as much as I can in advance. And I think letting go of you know, that ability to foresee the future is a pretty huge lesson that I took away from the trip and try to carry with me even now.
Right. Well, since we're almost like on the timeline, since we're almost to the end, let maybe just go ahead and talk about that last leg when you got the airdrop to Kotzebue.
Finally, the plane came, and in it was a foldable canoe that was a really wonderful gift that someone we had met by chance at Takahula Lake let us borrow. A pretty much complete stranger loaned us his brand new foldable canoe, which was a wonderful gift because otherwise we would have been stuck with our inflatable boats again. And after our experience in the Mackenzie Delta, we were really hesitant to take that on again. And all the food we could possibly need. And we even had a stove in that resupply, which was a real gift because we had been cooking on a fire for all of our time in the Arctic. So it felt like we had all these luxuries suddenly, you know, at our fingertips. And the next day we launched the canoe and still feeling a bit weak after not having eaten for so long, but we had plenty of food to make up for that. And it was still really rainy. The river was really flooded. We had heard a lot of people talk about how the upper reaches of the Noatak can be difficult because it's usually so bony and so little water, but we did not have that experience. We were just flushed downstream really rapidly because of the flooding. And a couple days into the canoeing trip down the Noatak, we came upon the Western Arctic caribou herd on their fall migration, and that was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had in my life, and certainly on the trip. And you know, when we were paddling, we first just saw a couple of antlers floating past, and they looked like sticks in the river, and then we realized quickly that it was caribou, and it was the herd just kind of starting to swim the river. And so we quickly pulled our canoe over to the riverbank and kind of ducked down in the bushes, and we're watching. And as we're sitting there, we'd heard this, what sounded just like something echoing from behind us, and all of a sudden all these caribou come out from the woods and start walking past us, and we're sort of surrounded by caribou and watching them swim the river, and a bunch of caribou moms and their calves, cows and calves, and the bulls, and they're all jumping in the river and swimming. And yeah, it was a really incredible experience, and we were sort of embedded in this migration for hours, and we just sat there and watched. In some cases, we'd have a caribou come up and sniff us 3 inches from our faces.
Wow.
And step over our outstretched legs. It was a truly incredible experience. And we had spent so many months kind of following the tracks of caribou. They were sort of our guides through some of the trickiest terrain up in the Arctic. And so to have the experience of actually seeing them on their migration was a really incredible way to sort of culminate the trip. And then by morning, they were all gone, and we continued boating down the river and had the chance to meet one other really amazing actually a couple of really amazing characters, and then finally reached the Chukchi Sea at the end of the Noatak River and made our last crossing into Kotzebue. And when we got there, my dad, who was, you know, kind of an important person in the book and certainly in our journey and, of course, in my life, had come from Anchorage to meet us. And so he was standing on the bridge waving as we paddled into Kotzebue. And that was another really amazing moment on the trip. And then there we were. The trip was over.
God, what an incredible journey. I don't know what to say.
Well, thank you. I feel really fortunate that we were able to take it and to get to see so much of Alaska and, you know, Northern Canada and some just really amazing wild country. And certainly on the trip, I felt more and more grateful for all the efforts so many people have put into kind of keeping these places as intact as they are.
Right. How did you get the idea? You know, when did you decide that you were going to write a book about this journey?
I think when I started the trip, I had in the back of my head that I would love to write about it. I have a background in creative writing. And so after meeting Pat in, down in Bellingham, he was finishing up his undergrad in art. And I was kind of interested in pursuing biology graduate work, but didn't quite find the right program. And so I ended up doing a master's of creative writing down at Western Washington University. And I'd always had a love for writing. I mean, I've been a really avid reader my whole life, and I think that's probably the best training for being a writer. At least that's what I've found to be true. And this seemed like a good opportunity to take on a big enough project that I could really get into it. And I had taken a hiatus from writing, at least creative writing, while I was doing my graduate work in biology, and I actually felt like it took some work to kind of untrain myself from scientific writing and try to find my more creative voice again. But from the beginning, I was interested in doing it, and I journaled pretty religiously on the trip as kind of a way of making myself accountable and thinking about taking on a larger project. And then I started the book not too long after we got back, but I began not really knowing where the book was going to go. It was started off more journalistic, and I knew that wasn't where it should be, but it was just a way to get started.
Right. How long did it take you to write the book and finish it?
It took me several years. It's been functionally done for about a year now with, you know, edits along the way, but I wrote it in its entirety, I would say, in about 3 years. And during that time, you know, there's a lot of other things happening in life. I had a full-time job as a biologist. I had a little boy, and then not too long after, another little boy. but I was writing pretty actively through all of that. And I would say that, you know, the book has been written multiple times, as any probably good book usually is, but it's gone through a lot of revision. It's certainly evolved a lot over the process of kind of getting into the story and understanding it better from the perspective of, you know, what did it mean to me? What would it mean to readers? What are some of the elements that are more universal and relatable to people, you know, whether they love wilderness trips or don't?
Have there been some important people or like mentors along the way who have supported you in writing this book and given you direction and help?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had some really amazing support from various people. I think, you know, having readers along the way is so critical. And I had some friends from my writing program and then other friends I know through, you know, all sorts of different means who were early readers, and they were really critical in shaping it. I would say both my agent and my editor at Little Brown have been huge assets and helped me. And, you know, Pat's been along the way. Both Pat and my sister have been pretty consistent readers and, you know, provided feedback. And Pat, for being such a key character in the book, has an amazing ability to sort of step back and see things objectively, whether he right. is part of the action or not. And so he's been a really important reader for me. And it's kind of interesting because he, you know, he reads a fair bit now, but he wasn't a reader growing up. That's not, you know, that was always one of our early disagreements is whether we keep the light up and, you know, or turn the light on in bed when you're going to sleep. Because I was like, yeah, I can't go to sleep without reading a book. And that was a foreign concept to him. So, but he's been really critical in that. And I would say I've certainly had many literary influences in my life. And some of the early ones stem back to, you know, Barry Lopez's Arctic Dreams and Terry Tempest Williams. And I really love writing about place and identity and relationships, human relationships, and how that relates to the natural world. And probably one of my sort of shining moments in this book was I got a postcard from Barry Lopez in my P.O. box in Haines. And I had written him a letter when we were on our sailing trip. We took a sailing trip with our kids this last summer up the Inside Passage. And I wrote him a letter, not really expecting a response. But, you know, I thought, hey, it's worth a try. Sure enough, there was a postcard from Barry Lopez that just, if nothing else happened with this book, that would have made me happy.
Yeah, it's really cool. What's the hardest part about writing for you? Like writing is really hard.
It is really hard, and I don't think there's any way around it. It's hard work, and I think that is probably what I've learned the most in this book, is that, you know, it's so much about persistence, and if you have to write a sentence 35 times to get it right, then that's what you have to do. And so, yeah, I think that part of the writing process is difficult. As I mentioned before, it was having to kind of transition from writing like a scientist to writing like a person who has a story to tell was a difficult transition for me, and it took a lot of kind of reorienting my perspective until I found a voice that felt more natural. And I think what worked really well for me once I figured it out was that the science and particularly the birds fit in the book, but they, you know, they needed to be a part of the story, and not, right. Nobody wants to read about science just for the sake of science, or at least most people don't who are picking up a memoir. But that was a really important part of the book for me. And once I found that voice, I think that was very natural. I'm not, you know, so much of a, like, want to divulge everything about myself and my personal life, although this is a very personal story.
Right.
I think getting feedback from people to help me kind of find the right combination of, you know, the personal and the adventure and the science was really critical.
Right. You just touched on it, but you know, the book really is quite personal. You know, you've talked eloquently and very personally about your relationship with Pat, and the same with your parents, you know, particularly your father. What was that process like for you, and how did you kind of make those decisions on, I guess, how much you wanted to self-disclose?
You know, maybe it would be a different situation for me if I had a really challenging relationship with my husband or with my dad. But they, in many ways, are relationships that I'm happy to talk about because they've brought so much to who I am as a person. And so it felt disingenuous not to talk about them. And honestly, I find it easier to write about other people than to write about myself. And so some of the parts about Pat actually got cut back quite a bit because I found myself, you know, writing a lot more about his stories and some of the interesting things that he's done in his life, you know, prior to me knowing him or while I've known him. So I think it was definitely a balancing act. I would write more and then kind of pare back and figure out what were those kind of key pieces that illustrated, you know, who Pat is to me and who Pat is to the rest of the world, and the same thing for my dad. And I think that was something that I discovered through the writing process. You know, I certainly felt that a lot on the trip. You know, my dad is definitely, he's always been kind of a grounding force for me. And so if I've run into any kind of problem, whatever it might be, you know, my car is broken down, or I can't figure out what to do about this problem at work, or all sorts of things like that. You know, my dad has always been that grounding force for me. And, you know, as you get older and become an adult, then some of those relationships change a little bit. And I think for my dad, the fact of his Parkinson's has also changed that. And one thing that happened on the trip that I was really amazing and kind of precious for me is that we transitioned back very naturally into our father-daughter roles. And he was, again, that person who fixed everything for me from a distance. You know, he was checking on our progress all the time. He was working out any kinks with resupplies. He was just doing all those things that he had always done for me, and it felt so natural to kind of revert to those roles. And I think that was a real gift. And in writing the book, when I thought about, you know, what was it about the time on the trip that was really special, even though we were physically very distanced, I felt closer to him and really closer to, you know, a lot of people in my life while I was out in the woods than maybe I had before leaving. And some of it, I think, is sort of the space that comes with and the mental clarity that comes with having time and, you know, being free from distractions and being able to really focus on the things that are important. And those relationships are absolutely the most important things in my life. And so the trip gave me the opportunity to really recognize that. And the book was a way to work through what all of that meant, you know, personally, I guess.
So what was harder, doing the actual trip or writing the book?
Oh, writing the book.
Really?
I think so.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
I don't know. Very different. So I can't answer clearly that one was harder than the other. I mean, the trip, if you asked me on the trip, you know, I probably would have said, oh, nothing's harder than this day, but, you know, on certain days anyway. But yeah, I think that it being so immediate in the moment of having an experience and having to deal with the circumstances, whatever they are, you know, out in the wilderness, versus the kind of day-to-day bash your head against the wall. I mean, the publishing industry writing is hard, and then publishing a book is even harder. At least that's what I found. And, you know, I feel so fortunate and so happy with my publisher and my editor and everything. It's been a really wonderful experience, but it was hard won. And there's plenty of days, you know, writing is such a private act that Sitting, you know, at my desk or in a corner somewhere trying to pound out these words and wondering if it's ever going to go anywhere. I mean, I didn't have a contract set up in advance or anything where I knew that somebody would publish it. I just was writing because I felt like I wanted to tell the story and was hoping that eventually it would find its way to readers, but there's no guarantees.
No. That's funny, though, because I was positive that you were going to say the trip was harder than writing the book.
Yeah, very different, but I don't know.
So what are a few of, like, the really important things that you learned about yourself taking that journey?
I think I learned a bit about being able to accept uncertainty, and that's something that I'm not good at by nature, and I think being able to embrace that as much as possible, especially, you know, as you get older and realize that life is inherently uncertain and tenuous and things are going to be lost along the way, and trying to be sort of present as much as possible in the moment, as cliche as that sounds. And that was definitely something that I walked away from the trip trying to carry with me. I think another important piece of what I learned is just the level of endurance that, you know, I'm sort of capable of, and I think that many of us are capable of. So much of the trip didn't require this super high level of technical ability, but it required an incredible amount of endurance and perseverance and just this faith that if you kept going, you would get there eventually. And I think I've really embodied that in so many of the things that I do, whether they're physical or not, that kind of this mentality that if you just continue, just see this, you know, a little bit farther, eventually, however difficult it is, it will get easier. You know, that's something that I think my dad's always told me in my life too, you know, oh, it's going to get better ahead. It can only get better from here. And, you know, he's usually right that if you can persist a little bit longer and trust that things will get easier, eventually they will.
Right. So what's important to you in your life today? And I guess the second part of that question is, like, has that changed since you did the trip?
I would say many of the same things are important to me. You know, I didn't mention in the last question, but my connection to the natural world and to science is still a very key part of my life. And I think spending all that time out kind of surrounded by natural history was a key return for me to come back to science. And that's still true now, that when I feel very ungrounded or am unsure about what's kind of happening with me at a given moment, going outside and remembering what it feels like to be small and to be humble is usually kind of the best medicine for me. So that part is still true. I mean, one thing that's changed a lot in my life is I now have two young children. I have two little boys. So in some ways that changes everything. But so much of the things that are still important to us, you know, we've been able to maintain. So we've still taken on adventures and kind of changed the nature of them a bit to accommodate kids. And this last summer, we spent 2.5 months coming up the Inside Passage by sailboat, and have been living remotely quite a bit this year. And try to take on sort of this lifestyle approach, I guess, with the kids when we can, and taking on trips that allow us to still get into some really wild places and for all of us to be challenged, but to do it in a way that, you know, isn't quite the same, of course, as without kids. So I think those things have both changed and stayed the same, and I hope that we can continue that as our kids get older. And you know, as they get older, it's also easier to take on more independent trips again that were difficult for a period of time. I mean, certainly in this kind of political and, you know, ecological context that we're in, my commitment to trying to continue work as a scientist and also, I think, working as a writer, I hope that part of my job is to help other people, you know, experience some of these amazing places that I've had a chance to see. And maybe that's one small contribution to hopefully changing the tide a bit of the direction that things have been going recently. And yeah, that's part of kind of what I see as my professional mission, not as a scientist. I mean, I try very hard to keep my politics separate from any of my work as a scientist, but I think the writing allows me a bit more room for kind of sharing my experiences more broadly.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Caroline's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of her immense wilderness wisdom and creative spirit to your next trip in the mountains. You can find Caroline's book, The Sun is a Compass, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or anywhere you can find good books on the internet. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you enjoy the music you hear on this show, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.
Guns and put that money in the bank. Woo! I know it's trying. There's no denying. You can look behind your back, but there's nothing left to see. And don't worry about me, I got friends and lots of plans. I'm just following my instincts. I'm just doing what I can.